our technology is not tailored for any specific disease area. It's more like a intuitive scientist in a box kind of approach. It can generate new theories that can collaborate with a scientist.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is how pharma R&D can use AI to accelerate, explore and understand and get new insights with explainable AI. Accelerating discovery using AI is becoming a critical competitive advantage in pharma for obvious reasons. But using AI for accelerated and automated disease understanding, drug design, and even bioinformatics can actually speed up the creation of good drugs and get them to market to the patients that need them much faster. Today, I'm with Caspar Willstrup, the CEO and founder of Abzu, who've used AI to create automated, explainable AI. Thank you for coming on the show, Caspar.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Could we start with you telling us a little bit about your background and how you got into this?
Yes, for sure. So I've been working with computers since the 80s. I got my first computer as an 11-year-old boy back in 1981. Computers have defined my life ever since. I did end up studying physics in the 90s, not computer science, but even there, it was mainly about using computers to do data analytics in physical problems. I founded my first company back in 99, a company that built hardware for high-performance computers to simulate different processes, including quantum fields. And I've been in the entrepreneurial space since, both working as a founder in my own companies, but also working on the venture capital side for several years. So I've seen the entrepreneurship ecosystem from both sides, particularly here in the Nordics, where I'm based. I'm based in Copenhagen. Okay. Today, I'm the founder of a company called Abzu. And in Abzu, we focus specifically on symbolic, explainable artificial intelligence, which is what we'll be talking about today. Yeah. I'm the CEO of the company. And I'm still very deeply involved in the research and development of the algorithms and the methods that we have developed and now are bringing to market in Abzu.
I'm really excited to get into some of this because, you know, explainable AI is such an important thing when you're in a really highly regulated industry like pharma. But before we go into that, what were the key challenges and gaps that you saw in the market when you decided to start Abzu?
Abzu is about bringing an approach to artificial intelligence called symbolic artificial intelligence back to life. It's actually a very old idea in AI to use artificial intelligence to come up with new symbolic understanding or new explanations for phenomena in the real world. But it's been lying dormant for quite a while, and a lot of AI has instead been focusing on a different approach to AI that characterized by neural networks and deep learning, which approaches things in a slightly different way. So when I established the company back in 2018, the idea was to bring symbolic AI to the forefront again, and also to combine it with other approaches to AI, like the neural network approaches, to deliver a kind of AI that could really explain phenomena and not just predict or make decisions. So from the beginning, we were focused on AI to explain things. Not particularly in pharma, life science, that came later. But for the first 2 years of the company's existence, we were just in deep research, just developing these algorithms that we have now brought to the market.
I actually read about your Q-Lattice explainable AI algorithm. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the Q-Lattice is the way we invented that approaches AI from this explainability first idea. So the Q-Lattice is all about encapsulating understanding of the world in such a way that we can use the system to generate hypotheses about the way the world works. So Q-Lattice can be thought of as a source of explanations that might or might not fit a problem that you're studying. So in that sense, it's an idea generator or a hypothesis generator that can generate likely explanations for any kind of phenomena. And then you can train the QLATs on data, abstract data or general data, and it becomes better and better at understanding the world that it has been trained on, and therefore at generating good explanations. But ultimately, the QLATs is designed to generate explanations with no data, which means that you can actually use the QLATs. Once you have a QLATs that has been trained on, like, the generic corpus of some kind of understanding, it can come up with new theories about things that were not there in its training corpus, such as diseases or molecular properties, and explain those theories in such a way that it's fairly easy for a researcher to then validate the theory and check whether it's actually true.
That's really interesting. What about the benefits of this on things like disease understanding, like biomarkers?
So in disease understanding, for example, you're very often, a lot of AI these days are focused on trying to predict whether a person will become sick or not. And that's not really the scientific approach. The scientific approach conventionally for several hundred years have been to come up with relatively simple theories that explains how something develops or something happens. That goes in all sciences, from behavioral science to physics, where I have my background, but obviously also in etiology or in understanding diseases. Why do people become sick in the first place? So there's been a lot of work with using AI to predict who will and will not develop certain diseases, perhaps based on their entire genome, or other omics kind of settings. But this work might be accurate in predicting if you have sufficient data about a patient population, but it doesn't actually bring the scientist any understanding of the process that leads to this disease in the first place. Yeah. So one thing that I have objected to for quite a while is that we tend to default to these kind of black box predictive approaches even in science these days, where we deviate from the ideals of science to come up with theories that are justifiable in their own right, and then towards, all right, let's give up on the theories and just go for the predictions. And to me, that's not really science in the purest sense, at least. So when you use our approach, or symbolic approaches in general, the aim is first and foremost to understand the process that leads to the disease. That can be, often that will mean that you are actually bisecting the disease, because many diseases are more than one disease, or there are many processes leading to a specific disease. So understanding could involve things such as segmenting the patients into groups that actually have different etiologies or different reasons for being sick in the first place, which can in itself be super enlightening, because they might then also need different kinds of treatments. And at other times, it just means seeping through this vast space of possible explanations. Like, just if you think of genes combining in various ways, there's so many different ways that they could in principle combine to cause a disease. It's difficult for a human to oversee those, but it doesn't mean that the explanation isn't simple. It just means that it's a needle in a haystack, and we never found that needle. So in all of those cases, the aim of the QLATs and our approach is to not go for predictive modeling, but instead go for explanatory modeling. And these explanations are, of course, also good predictors, because true explanations are super powerful predictors. That's the fundamental idea of science. Whereas the opposite doesn't hold. You can have a very strong predictor that actually doesn't have any predictive explanatory power at all.
Yeah. What about in RNA therapeutics?
Yeah, so we've worked in for relatively arbitrary reasons, it's fair to say, due to the people who ended up joining the company as we grew. We worked in disease understanding and RNA therapeutics as a company. In RNA therapeutics, it's more about the molecular properties of a drug of some kind, typically a short oligo, which is like a short sequence of DNA or RNA nucleobases tied in chain, and we are interested in trying to understand why these simple drugs have various drug properties, such as like stable, or whether they bind to a target in RNA, for instance, or in messenger RNA, for example, depending a little bit on the actual modality of the RNA therapeutic. But we're specifically interested in drug properties, toxicity, stability, efficacy, And these properties are themselves individual scientific problems. You can think about them as something you could, if you collected massive number of amounts of data, you use traditional machine learning to study it. But with our approach, you don't actually need much data, sometimes even no data at all, because the QLATs will generate hypotheses about why are these drugs toxic or stable, or why do they fold in a certain way, or why do they have these off-target effects. So all things that are essentially scientific questions, but in having a scientific answer rather than a predictive answer, you can incorporate that knowledge into its entire R&D chain. So suddenly, if you know that a certain, say, shape in the 3' end of an RNA molecule has a certain tendency to produce some kind of toxicity, that applies to any RNA molecule that has that thing, this property. So science, in the sense of theories, has this power that it's very general. So once you know that something is true, it's true in many more situations than from where you actually discovered it.
Yeah.
So ultimately what that means is that in RNA therapeutics, our customers are building up corpuses of knowledge, of understanding of the properties of sequences of RNA or DNA. And that allows them to much more efficiently design molecules that in the first go, once you start going into the wet lab testing them, have a much higher probability of living up to the criteria for which you designed them for.
Yeah.
All this achieved with the fraction of the data that you would have needed if you'd gone the machine learning or conventional AI route.
That's very cool. So how much less data can you get away with?
The interesting thing is you can actually get away with no data.
Wow.
That's a little bit in the limit. But to maybe give you a concept about how that works, a procedure, when humans do symbolic reasoning, we don't actually need data to construct procedures.
True.
We construct our procedures based on prior understanding of the situation. Like if I ask you how many cars are in a specific city, or how many airplanes take off from Copenhagen each day, you could without actually knowing the number, you could devise a procedure that would quickly allow me to answer that question.
Yeah.
And then that procedure could be wrong or it could be right, but you could generate it with no data. But then if the procedure is simple enough that I could try to understand it myself, and do I want to spend the time to actually test this procedure on real data, then I can make that informed decision that I believe this enough that I'll collect maybe 10 data points and then test your procedure on that. But since the procedure did not come from the data, it came from like your intuition, 10 data points can be enough to get a very high statistical confidence in the model, in this procedure. Which is very different from machine learning in the traditional sense. So even, let's say you have a disease where you only have 10 patients and you come up with a genetic explanation for this disease, then those 10 patients are sufficient to give a very, very high, trust in the accuracy of the model, because you're using all those 10 data points to actually test the procedure. So this is a very powerful idea in two senses. One is that you can work with, in the limit, no data, but obviously, ultimately, you need some data to validate a scientific theory, but not much. And the other is that in the loop, before you actually make the decision to go out and do the experiment, you can have a human domain expert who knows something about the topic, validating whether this procedure is worth testing based
very
on their prior knowledge.
It reminds me of way many years ago when I was in neuroscience, with one person's brain, if you've got a double dissociation between particular pathways, it's basically valid in everyone's brain. So it's very interesting. It's kind of similar, which of course a lot of AI is similar to brain science in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. But I think what you're saying there is really a scientific, a scientific claim, right? That a lot, quite often, a simple scientific theory has a super large explanatory power, not because of some statistical fluke, because it actually captures the underlying process that causes the phenomenon you're studying.
Exactly.
So there's a causal element here that science actually ultimately relies on causality for the simplicity that we find in many scientific rules.
So interesting. Now, without breaking any NDAs of your clients, could you maybe give some use cases of how you've applied this in disease understanding or drug discovery in that kind of area?
Yeah. So the stories that are easier to talk about are actually the ones that happens before the actual drug development starts, like when you're still at the disease understanding phase, where we work together with both public researchers but also large pharma companies to identify. But ultimately, the idea is to identify new targets for drugs, like by understanding a disease better and the disease pathway, you can more specifically design drugs that intervene with those pathways. And we worked in various, actually a lot of different disease areas, from neuroscience to inflammatory bowel disease to liver diseases of various kinds. So, and these are the specific diseases are covered by NDAs, but we've been pretty broad in our approach to diseases, because our technology is not tailored for any specific disease area. It's more like a intuitive scientist in a box kind of approach. It can generate new theories that can collaborate with a scientist. And then once you have these understandings that are often delivered to the scientist and the customer's side, often we don't necessarily even know about them from our side, because we just deliver the technology. Or also help with the actual research. It depends a little bit on the collaboration. The new disease understanding leads to more specific targets, also sometimes more narrow targets to subpopulations, where you can understand, including the biomarker, why are these, what I've said in the beginning, that you get this like this breakup of the many different pathways leading to the disease. Yeah. And that can then mean that you can now develop more specific, of course, also less general drugs, but that are much more efficacious against specific subpopulations in this disease population. Yeah. So this is an area where about half of our pharma collaborations are in. And the other half are very specifically, often in toxicity, actually, in RNA therapeutics. Antisense oligonucleotides, which is one approach, or small interfering siRNAs, and various other approaches, where we very often, the kind of problems we look at are toxicity related. More recently, we worked with lipid nanoparticles, understanding the structures of the molecules in the nanoparticles themselves, and understanding the properties based on those nanoparticles. So in RNA therapeutics, for example, not only in RNA therapeutics, also in RNA vaccines, you often wrap the actual active drug in a lipid nanoparticle that has played some role either in delivery or stability of the ultimate drug. But this is, so the nanoparticle itself is not the drug, it's a delivery vehicle. But again, here there's a lot of scientific questions about why do they have these good or bad properties that we find in them.
Yeah.
This is a new area that we've gone into.
Wow.
So generally, I think this is applicable very broadly. And I can also say that independent researchers, so we have a light version of our technology that you can actually use for free as long as it's for non-commercial use. So there's a lot of independent researchers that have just adopted the QLASs for research in areas that we have no specific knowledge about, ranging from space science to environmental science, behavioral science, energy consumption, and many other use cases where we just see these papers, research papers pop up where our technology has been used to discover some new understanding of some phenomenon.
That's very cool. It's nice seeing it happen without you having anything to do with, I mean, you're doing the underlying part, but that's very cool. Yeah. What about, in the last year, we've had so much about generative AI. I mean, I know generative AI started in 2014, so it's not particularly new, but because of ChatGPT, everyone's talking about generative AI. Let's hope it pipes down soon. But do you think that these developments are going to affect pharma R&D?
Well, I think there's some hype. So first of all, generative AI is really bad at generating new things. Like, so interestingly enough, we call it generative AI because it generates things, but it doesn't really generate things that wasn't there in its
training. Exactly.
And that is becoming clearer and clearer as people are getting experience with it. Like sometimes it can come up with new ideas because you, the user, have not heard about it, but it rarely, actually never has. Exactly. It's not a built-in capability of it to come up with new ideas, like in the innovative sense. But that being said, generative AI and language models, maybe in particular, are a super powerful interface concept. The idea of a human being able to interact with a computer system in a much more intuitive way through generative AI is very powerful, and it's going to change the way every industry works, as already has happened. But I think we need to keep our eyes on the fact that generative AI does not only very to a very limited degree is it able to actually accelerate scientific research in any meaningful sense.
Yeah.
But it can be the interface between the scientist and the tools that could accelerate.
That's true. Yeah.
So what we're working on today in APSU is that we're actually wrapping our QLattice algorithm in a hybrid configuration where the generative part, the language models and other types of generative components are the interface between a human user, a scientist, or maybe even a non-scientist, and the symbolic part, the QLattice part that delivers the actual explanations. And that seems to solve some important productivity problems in the scientific research or in drug development specifically.
Yes. And in medical affairs and areas like that, it's great for summarizing the data and put, you know, that's out there, etc. What does the future look like, do you think, for pharma AI applications?
Well, I know the most about the drug development part.
Focus on that.
Yeah, but we have some thoughts, and we're also having use cases even in manufacturing and even in marketing. So again, this technology is super broadly applicable. But in the drug development side, there is no doubt that AI, the generative AI, will enable many more people to benefit from technology. From the the interface argument, it will also ultimately be able to automate some of the work processes that we're today having humans do. So also displace some jobs. There's no doubt about that. In the agent sense, I know from one of your recent podcasts as well that you've talked a lot about agents.
Yeah.
And agents are an important concept. It's like this long running idea of a workflow that's being taken over from automating of a complete human workflow.
Yeah.
But in all those cases, whether it's an agent doing the work or a human doing the work interacting with an AI, the AI, if it's generative, does not really have the capabilities to do much. It needs to turn around and use some tools. And here, our approach, our kind of AI tools, I think have a much bigger potential to really do something in science. Not so much automate or make process more efficient, but actually accelerate the rate of discovery in the sense that we can get a much clearer picture about why people become sick, even in rare disease areas, and also have a much easier path to ultimate drug, including the clinical trial phase, because if you have a very good understanding of why the drug works in a certain way, that simplifies the clinical trial in many ways. First of all, you can select the right patients. Like if you're selecting based on a clear scientific understanding of the disease and how that matches with the drug that you're testing, then you can make sure that you only select people who will actually respond to your drug. And that gives a much, much stronger signal in the clinical trial.
Absolutely.
But there's also some structures about the way we do clinical trials that should be updated to accommodate for these new kinds of approaches. Because there's perhaps some conservatism in the requirements for how you set up a trial that doesn't really allow you to learn that much along the way. We've seen that quite often, that like a clinical trial that has actually failed and we get access to the data and then we run and we're like, well, if you just done this instead, and you could see that already after maybe a couple of weeks, you could have seen that, right, this population group was actually two population groups and you needed to just focus on that. So redefine the trial.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of that with AI these days, aren't we? That we can actually get those kind of insights so much faster.
Yes. While the trial is still running, right?
Exactly,
the regulatory environment would accommodate for that. I think we could get more targeted, more efficacious, more safe drugs, but of course also narrower drugs because it will then target a narrower population.
And also, I think the FDA is changing. So in 2022, they actually changed their regulations so that for originally animal testing and phase two human testing, you don't actually need animals or humans anymore. So it's being done with digital twin and synthetic data now. Yeah. Not all the way through, but it speeds up at least those first two phases, which is pretty interesting. Yeah. And while we're on regulations, I was actually on a panel for the European Commission about the AI Act. And so if we think about all of these new regulations that are coming in, both in the EU as well as the US, what do you think pharma companies need to look out for with these? Because there's so many changes and they're all up in the air at the moment.
Mm. starting with the AI Act, in the European AI Act. So the idea of classifying uses of artificial intelligence into these risk categories, including the high risk category, is probably a sane approach, because it gives us like a recent approach to when we do what with AI. And I have fully supported that actually in all my public interactions as well. There are aspects of the AI Act that I'm a little bit more concerned about, but this aspect is of course one that I actually support. It's a sane and safe approach. It does mean that almost all of the many medical applications of AI have landed in this high risk use case, in this high category, and that of course means that everybody working, whether it's with diagnostics or drug development or clinical trials or prognostics or medical devices, needs to be aware both of what is required for high risk use cases, but also how to then live up to those requirements. And one of the main requirements, there's a couple of requirements that I find particularly interesting and important, also because they support what I've been saying since founding Absolute before. If you base your decision system on massive amounts of data, it's very difficult to ascertain that this data is not biased or contains it becomes actually impossible in my opinion to live up to at least the spirit of the AI Act if you have a decision system that is a black box decision system that has been trained on say a million patients, because who are they? How does these many factors in those patients actually interact with? What are the biases? So that's one problem, where if just the mere fact that you can, that science and symbolic AI, our kind of AI, allows you to limit the number of patients that you actually derive the decision system from, makes your life a lot easier when you deploy decision systems based on AI. But the other aspect, which is less clear, and I mean the final manifestation of the Act has not really come out, we haven't seen the implementation yet. I believe there will be pretty strict requirements on being able to explain specifically how the model behaves. What does the model do to this population versus this population when you use it for diagnostic or prognostic purposes? And I think that is fair. Like, we can't really have a black box oracle making life or death decisions for humans. And then when the human turns around and asks why, the only answer we can give is, well, computer says so. It doesn't really fit well with my values, at least. So again, here symbolic approaches is super powerful, because you can explicitly and very detailed answer that question. The reason this drug is not prescribed to you is because you don't have the specific mutation for which it's designed, period. Or the reason we don't give this drug to this is because you smoke. If that is why, then we need to be able to say that very specifically.
That does remind me, sorry to interrupt, that just reminded me of that case quite a few years ago, where IBM Watson did a cancer treatment recommendation for oncologists, and the data was not good, and a lot of what they were recommending was actually unsafe for the patients, and it had to be pulled. So that backs up your argument about, you know, it's been trained on a lot of data, but who are these people and what is that data and how accurate or unbiased is it?
I sometimes compare that approach to the Oracle of Delphi. Like, imagine that we have a super smart oracle, but it's like so much smarter than a human, and then you just ship in data, and the Oracle reads all that data, and then ultimately we have a system where we can go in and say, oh, wise Oracle, answer this question for me, and then it gives you an answer. And when you say wise, it's, I have no idea, or it's not for you not for you humans to understand this stuff. Maybe that's fine if we're using our AI to do like predictive marketing or whatever, but if it's life or death decisions,
it's
any high risk use case, like, I really agree with the AI Act in that in these high risk use cases, it is not fine. We'll create a biased, unfair society with arbitrary decisions and a lack of trust from humans in the technology, because, like, if you don't understand, how can we trust?
And that's I hear that again and again in pharma. You know, it's that trust element is so critical with AI as well. Just one final thing on regulations. What do you think that the regulators need to keep in mind when they're drafting the AI regulation to avoid hurting pharma AI use?
Well, I think there's two things I want to say about that. One is like on the implementation side. The track record from GDPR is a little bit worrisome. So GDPR is not related here, right? But everybody in pharma knows about that as well. GDPR, I think if you look at the intention of the regulation, is like hard to disagree with. It's fair. People should know if their data are being used for various purposes. But the implementation ended up being super bureaucratic. Like it's very, very difficult for a company to live up to all the requirements, not in not violating the principles of GDPR, but in actually following through all the procedures and routines and requirements along the route to using personal data. So this ultimately is based on a regulatory framework that does not trust the industry.
Yeah.
So the reason you implement all that red tape in the process is because you don't trust the industry to not break the law. And this is different from like the more traditional approach in legislation, where you say this is what you must and mustn't do, and if you do it anyway, we punish you. Right? But it's like an after the fact kind of thing. And you could say, all right, then there's a risk that the law is broken, and that's what we're trying to avoid. But on the other hand, like this idea that regulators need to inspect the very process in order to ensure that the law is not ultimately broken has really hurt European industries with the GDPR, really. And it has also turned the public even against GDPR. GDPR is not something we should be against as a principle. The same thing could happen with AI, with the AI Act. Again, I have no complaints with the use case regulations and high risk versus moderate versus low versus no risk use cases and the requirements for those. But if we implement something where you have to follow through a long regulatory process with approvals along the way, it's going to slow us so much down. And it's all based on mistrust in the industry, not in AI, but in the industry. This is something that worries me, because if it happens, it'll happen in some jurisdictions. It'll happen in Europe, perhaps, but not necessarily other places.
The FDA, again, did something quite cool in that respect for AI within medical devices. So they had the 21st Century Cures Act a few years ago, probably about 5 years ago now. And in that, they look at the processes that the company are using to develop the AI, because they realize that they can't go back every week because AI is constantly being tweaked and improved. But they wanted to look at how the company are actually doing the processes, and then they approve it based on that without having to change it. So I do see the FDA actually, out of a lot of the regulators, kind of doing some forward-thinking things, which is quite nice.
Yeah. Yes. There's certainly awareness on this from the regulatory side, both in the US, but also here in Europe. Certainly awareness of it. Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see where it lands. But there is a risk that it becomes very bureaucratic once it gets in.
Yes. When I was on that panel, the guy from the European Commission said it would be another 2 years before they finalized the AI Act. Yes. So, it takes a while.
Yes. And so, will be interesting.
Yeah, exactly. The pandemic saw us race for vaccines, and AI was used in a lot of that, and we were much faster, although there are lots of concerns about safety because we didn't do all the processes we have to normally do, but ultimately it was successful. How can AI impact the development and the timeline of development to produce pharmaceuticals fast? So you had that in that pandemic situation, but we've got, 236 billion being wiped off the revenue of pharma in the next few years from the patent cliff. So getting drugs through faster to market is a big interest to all pharma boards at the moment. How do you think AI can affect that?
Yeah. So first of all, the pandemic was actually easy, because it immediately, sadly, but very quickly, provided us with massive amounts of data.
Yes,
which made it a very good target for conventional black box machine learning. Which also meant that the mRNA vaccines were like had a lot of tailwind from very quickly studying or very quickly predicting the properties of these long mRNA molecules. Again, this was possible because we had so much data. Yeah. We sacrificed the explainability. I have concerns about that. I mean, probably had to act, but I have concerns about some of the decisions that were made,
whether we actually knew enough about the molecular properties and how they interacted with the body to move as fast. But again, desperate times, desperate measures.
Yeah.
The thing is, the ordinary picture for the drug industry is not pandemics. It's not, I hope not, at least. It's like many, many small diseases. Like all the big blockbusters have
been made. Done. Yeah.
So we need the industry needs to look at and find ways to be super profitable on much narrower disease populations. And these diseases are difficult because, as I said, they're often degenerate in the sense that there are many different diseases that we think of as one. Cancer is the obvious example. Like there's such a thing as cancer. It's so many different diseases.
Loads of molecular pathways and biomarkers,
Exactly. So in order to do drugs in this, like where the easy fruits have been picked, we need to accept that we're targeting narrower patient groups, which in turn means that we need procedures that are really good at coming up with drugs based on very little data. And here AI in the black box sense doesn't do much.
Yeah. But so, Q-labs.
I have high hopes for the Q-labs.
Exactly. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because it's basically, you know, at the moment without AI, without a lot of AI, it's still costing, you know, $1 billion to $2 billion to get a drug to market. And you've got such a small patient population, it means the drug prices go way up. And now we've had the Inflation Reduction Act last year, which and loads of drugs still under patent have had their drug prices slashed. So we really need AI to speed that whole process up, which will decrease the costs of getting it and time of getting a drug to market. I don't know what you've seen, but I've come across a lot that quote 60 to 70% increase a decrease in the time to market. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, that's probably where we are now with the best.
Yeah.
We need to go lower than that. This
we do, yeah.
Fortunately, it's a win-win situation in the sense that everybody has an interest here. There's nobody who benefits from these massive
long times and processes. Costs. Yeah, absolutely.
Societies or governments that pay the bill want them lower, and they should be motivated to also look at the regulatory landscape for developing drugs to make the price of drug development lower. If we can explain how that is done in a safe way, the industry obviously needs new drugs, new patents. So although yes, the prices that they can get when they finally succeed are massive, it still is like both a volume problem, and it's also a trust problem. People are skeptical about the pharma industry as such because of these high prices. And ultimately the patients also, well, need the drugs, obviously. That's why we're all doing this, which is to give people better lives. So it's a win-win-win. So we should, if the industry, the patients and the regulators trust each other that this is the aim, we should be able to find ways. And I think from a technological perspective, there are solutions. Again, moving away from black box, because black box is probably not the solution.
Absolutely.
But moving away from this, there are technical solutions as well. And those that aren't there yet, like humans are smart, let's invent them. And get this done. So, and I'm an optimist. Everybody knows that I keep saying that about myself. So I believe we'll fix this. Hopefully sooner rather than later.
It has to be sooner. Anyway, we're kind of in a lot of trouble as an industry if we don't fix it soon.
But so are the patients that are sick, and so are the regulators or the governments that pay the high drug prices. So
Because there's something like 8,000 rare diseases, and we've only got, you know, around 100 and something that have got drugs for. So there's thousands of diseases with people that are suffering that have no treatments whatsoever. So,
And then it is the next frontier in health.
Absolutely.
Massive problems have fortunately been solved.
Yes, that's true. Looking ahead, you know, what's the envisaged direction for Absu, and how do you see it evolving to meet these changing industry demands?
Yeah, so the QLADS is too powerful to be restricted to just drug development. It's a technology that actually, as I said, we have people using it for space science. We have people using it for environmental science. So we need to find routes where this technology can come into the hands of people who need answers to these questions, even outside of the realm of science. It can be like, how do you make better windmills? How do you better predictive maintenance of your equipment? Or actually all sorts of use cases where you have little data and need understanding. We need to make sure that our technology gets into the hands of the people who have those needs. So for Upsho as a company, we're treading a balance between staying with our like our core customers and what we're working on in drug development, but at the same time expanding out and getting this technology, typically I think through partners will be the main path, into other industries as well. So this is something that we focus a lot on, also because Upsho's growth as a relatively small company depends on people understanding the vast potential of the Q-Lattice and getting that out there in all of these use cases as fast as possible.
So it's been so interesting talking to you. I found this so fascinating, what you've done and the applications and, you know, where it could go is incredible. And I'm sure some of the listeners may want to get in touch with you. So for anyone listening who is interested in talking further to Casper and his team, you can go to abzu.ai and see some of the things they're doing, read about Q-Lattice and get in touch. Thank you so much for your time today. Really, really fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much for having me here. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.